Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 361. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are James Jones.
Hey.
Our speedy editor, Guillaume Veillette.
And thorough.
The speedy and thorough, yes. He's a good doctor and thorough. Rounding out the quartet this week, we have our good buddy, John Lindemann.
I'm not always here physically, but I am always here spiritually.
Until the restraining order kicks in.
You are the spirit of our non-listeners.
You're my spirit animal too, Johnny. Don't forget that.
In that way, yeah, that's right. I learned today. I am the penguin in the igloo in your head.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we're going to get kicked off here with a bunch of new business, and we'll hear from John and what he's been doing. But we do have listener mail coming up later in the show. I'm excited to catch up on that a little bit. We never completely ever catch up on listener mail, but we will do some of the best ones we've received lately, and that'll be good to hear from you guys once again. So first up this week on new business, we're going to hear from Guillaume, who has some DLC and then a non-game new business. I recall this being a discussion on Twitter.
Right. The Pikmin DLC I just got, and it came out this week. But funny thing, it was announced a couple of weeks ago in a Nintendo Direct, and they showed off...
This is the Christmas one?
Yeah, they showed off the Christmas level where you've got trees and, you know, gifts all around, and looked very cheery, it looked very cool. It's, you know, new assets that weren't originally in Pikmin 3. So, but the funny thing is I downloaded DLC a couple of weeks ago, not knowing that it was not going to, this particular level was not going to be released until this week. So I looked at the four new missions that I bought, two weeks ago, and I was like, crap.
I jumped the gun.
Yeah. And those were just remixed levels. So they were just basically the levels that are already in the game, but a little bit changed up, which is not that interesting.
Right.
Thankfully, you know, like each set of DLC was only $2, but, still it kind of sucked. This new DLC is new levels, but thankfully the Christmas level is actually free for everyone.
Cool.
Yeah, like everyone who owns the game should have downloaded like automatically if they've got their Wii U set for it, this new level. So you can go ahead and play it for yourself. It's pretty cool. It's got, you know, well, new assets, which is nice, and it's very colorful, and you know, it's kind of timely, so it's pretty cool to have.
Now, when you say new assets, can you? Some people may not be familiar with that term. We kind of throw things around sometimes.
New stuff. They made content for the game.
Yeah.
So, like, new items, new graphics, new. Are there new enemies?
No. Unfortunately, they didn't go that far. They only, like, it's the same enemies. You're still fetching fruit. And it's still the same fruit. It's not Christmas themed fruit. I would have liked to see that, you know.
Like a fruitcake.
Yeah. And there's pizza though, for some reason. There's old discarded pizza.
The pizza fruit. One of my favorites.
But yeah, like it's basically like they created a new level made out of things that are not found in Pikmin 3. Whereas the levels are included for the battle and the treasure missions in Pikmin 3 are only basically reusing environments and enemies and music that are in the game, in the main game. It is what it is, I guess. It's just nice to have something new to look at doing these missions. Unfortunately, even though the four other missions, the four other levels that you pay for are also new assets, they're really not as interesting as this one. So, you know, to pretty much everyone who's not in love with doing the missions in Pikmin 3, I say just, you know, be glad that you got the best of the bunch for free, because the other ones are not really worth downloading. While
but the, for you, the... I would imagine that you like this new content, the ones that you paid for, better than the last set that you paid for. You said they're new assets, so it's,
well, you know
should
what?
Be a little it's, fresher, it... right?
They're really disappointing, to be honest, because, okay, let me tell you what the names of these four new sets of levels are. There's the Rust Yard. So, yeah, that's of rust. That's of discarded junk, which is not that... Actually, there's not that much discarded junk. It's mostly just, you know, it looks very much like an old... any Pikmin 3 level. There's the Forgotten Caves. So, caves. There's some Beastly Caverns. So caves, caverns, you know, there's lots of diversity there. And the last one actually has something new. Like it has these conveyor belts.
It's a chasm.
Yeah, a chasm. Yeah.
A desert.
So not that fresh.
No, very gray, very disappointing. As I said, the one with the conveyor belts is kind of interesting because you've got these buttons and these conveyor belt, so you throw Pikmin in the buttons and you can make the conveyor belt go the other way, try to save time, you know, and, you know, it's a mini puzzle in there, but...
Because getting around in Pikmin isn't already laborious and confusing enough. With 100 guys following you around, now you get to play with conveyor belts. Now, that sounds kind of annoying to me, but can you, if someone was listening to this and they thought that sounded really interesting, could they buy just that one, or do you get all four for the $2?
Yeah, actually, it's not $2 this time. Previously, the previous remixed levels that you can buy, the first set of DLC, was $2 for each set of missions. So you could pay $2 for the battle missions, you could pay $2 for the treasure missions. And this time, they make you pay $5 for both sets at the same time. So you can't pick and choose at all. You're getting everything, you're paying a little bit more for it, and... I don't know. I don't know what $5 is worth to our listeners, but I I don't think it's that amazing of a set of DLC.
Yeah, I mean, I think if they made new Pikmin stuff and it didn't impress you, it's not going to impress most people. Because you like this game more than a lot of people I talk to, and it was definitely more than me.
Well, sure. But the mission stuff, I do enjoy. It's pretty challenging. It can get really challenging if you try to get the platinum medals. But I did not really get addicted to it all that much. I do enjoy them. But yeah, I wouldn't recommend getting this DLC unless you're really nuts about the missions.
Now, as our resident multiplayer tester, did you ever try the battle mode in Pikmin 3? Because I thought it was pretty cool at E3. That's the only time I've ever played it.
Yeah, unfortunately, the game hasn't really caught on with the girlfriend. It's just a little bit, I don't know.
It's not cute enough.
It's it's a little bit complicated, and I don't think she's really used to that type of game.
All right, well, that's too bad. Yeah. All right. So, what else have you been playing, Guillaume?
No, I've been playing lots. I'm currently taking a break from breaking my head against the last level of Super Mario, which is really, really challenging.
Are you sure it's the last level?
It is the very last level, and it's. Yeah, it's very frustrating. But when I'm not doing that, I talked over a year ago about this book, The History of Mario, that I got from Pix & Love Publishing, this French publishing company that makes these books about video games. They've got tons of stuff in French. They've got a couple of books in English, translated. I can't speak to the translation because that's not what I'm reading. But in addition to The History of Mario, they're also publishing The History of Nintendo, volumes 1, 2, 3, and it's still going on. So I bought, at the same time as I bought The History of Mario, I bought The History of Nintendo, volume 1, which covers 1889 to 1980. So it kind of stops right when Game & Watch begins. And volume 2 covers Game & Watch. And volume 3 covers Famicom. So it's very, very, very comprehensive.
Yeah.
And so I started reading this book maybe a year ago. And you know, initially I really enjoyed it because it gives you all the history of Yamauchi, you know, where he comes from, his, you know, dad and granddad and all of that. You get a glimpse of how the company got started. And then I lost interest in it because it all of a sudden it kind of became a catalog of stuff that Nintendo made. Really, really amazing pictures, but I'm not really a visual guy. I don't really, you know, I can only stare at Hanafuda cards for so long. But eventually I picked it back up, and there's way more interesting info just with all those pictures and all those product descriptions that I could have guessed. And I'm actually really, I've really, really enjoyed it. For instance, you know, like you think of the Game Link, the Game Boy's Game Link, and you think, well, yeah, sure, it's probably, you know, like the Game Boy came up with that. But no, like there was actually this electronic Mahjong game in 1980, like 9 years before the Game Boy came out, and it did have a Game Link accessory.
Really?
Yeah. Or you know, like it's fantastic to read, you know, like today you'll get Nintendo will be criticized for cutting corners, basically, like trying to cut costs at all costs, just at the cost of the features, you know, and they'll ditch the, you know, some port in the GameCube or things like that. And people don't really, you know, like they think it's a new development. Oh, Nintendo's not really producing consoles that are as powerful as the competitors. That's just, you know, that's so not Nintendo. Because the Super Nintendo was cutting edge or whatever people think. But then you read this, and back when Nintendo was making toys, they actually took the market by storm with their RC car that could only turn left. It could only turn left as a cost-cutting measure because Gunpei Yokoi had the mandate from Yamauchi to make, you know, the cheapest remote controlled car that they could make, and so he had to use just one frequency, and the car basically goes forward no matter what. Actually it spins in place, and when you press the button it goes forward, and if you want to turn right, well, you got to turn, you know, 45 degrees, just
270,
just,
really
just like Derek Zoolander.
Yeah, actually. So, and that actually was a success for them because, you know, like their RC car was maybe like less than half the price of anything else on the market. And that was at a time when remote controlled cars in Japan were really out of price for the average family. So,
well, Japan was coming out of a recession that was brought on in part by the war.
Yeah, yeah. And
I mean, Japan's economy didn't recover until the 80s.
Yeah, and you know, like, so they've got a lot of this stuff going on. It's really fascinating to read. And one of the things that's really remarkable is their ability to come back from the brink of, I don't know, of bankruptcy or things like that. Like, they've had some really ridiculous failures, and it's just amazing how they can always seem to grab the some sort of success out of that. So yeah, like it's pretty fascinating. And I find myself really, like, so far it hasn't really been, Miyamoto hasn't really entered the picture yet. So it's all Yamauchi and some Gunpei Yokoi. And I wasn't really familiar all that much with what he's done. I just knew, okay, so he created the Game Boy. He, you know, he has something to do with Metroid. And I was pretty ignorant about what he brought to Nintendo, but From what I can see here, he pretty much made Nintendo, like the Nintendo that we know today. And I can't wait to, like, to read the sequel to this, Volume 2, because I want to see what else, you know, Yokoi is just going to invent, and what other challenges he's going to face. Like, these are almost like characters now in the novel. It's a really, really good book.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you should say that about Yokoi, because he was effectively kind of put to the side.
Well, because Virtual Boy.
Yeah, Virtual Boy.
Yeah. Yeah, but you, like, he brought so much money to Nintendo, it's insane. And really, like, it doesn't look like Nintendo was all that interested in the toy market until Yamauchi saw Yokoi just, you know, making little toys in his spare time, because the maintenance of playing card printing machines didn't take his whole day, you know? And so, you know, Yamauchi recognized his talent and decided to make him his head engineer, and just told him, okay, just come up with as many concepts as you can. And many of them really, really worked. They've been extremely huge sellers. And I don't know. I really like the guy now.
It's super interesting. I will have to look for this on my Kindle. All right, so why don't we catch up with John Lindemann and hear about what he's been playing?
All right, well, I have some final thoughts on The Last of Us. I finished that a little while back. You know, the first game that comes to mind is BioShock, really. Not so much in the terms of the gameplay or the type of game that it is, but I feel like in the same way that people kind of fell in love with that game because of, in my opinion, the world it creates and the story that's told and, you know, it's sort of all the, you know, the Ayn Randisms and stuff like that. I kind of feel like people have fallen in love with Last of Us because of the way the story is told and sort of the world they create, not necessarily the gameplay. You know, that's, you know, the gameplay is, it's still, to me, it's still very much like Uncharted. Even though they flip it, you know, there's much more stealth than there is, you know, shootouts and stuff like that.
I can already hear the groans from Gaff.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I'm sure people will say that I'm derping really hard, but you know what? At the end of the day, you're still walking through rooms of people killing them, only killing them in different ways than you are in Uncharted.
And I think I've played a little more of this since the last time you brought it up, and I certainly haven't gotten as far as you, but I think there may also be something to do with kind of the physics of the characters, which is just, you know, when you get two third-person games out of the same studio in the span of 5 years, they're going to probably have some, you know, just like how all Nintendo platformers have a certain kind of feel to the jumping. There's something about the momentum that your character has, you know, when you're walking and then you stop, and there's, you know, there's a certain amount of drift with that when you let off the joystick, and there's kind of the length of time it takes to do climbing animations and stuff like that. And there's the, you know, when you push things around to make a handhold for you to climb up to a higher place, there's all these things feel very familiar. And even if they are used differently than in Uncharted or use them a lot less often or whatever, just when you do these certain discrete actions within the gameplay, they feel very, very familiar if you've played Uncharted. And so I think from that standpoint, I don't think you're crazy.
And, you know, am I saying that this is just like Uncharted? No, of course not. It's very different. It has a very different feel, a very different tone. But to me, especially near the end, I mean, obviously you haven't beaten it. You're not all the way through. But especially at the end, they kind of fall back. There's a lot less stealth and a lot more shooting near the end. And I found myself near the end of the game, I found myself honestly saying, I just wish that I could watch the rest of the cutscenes and just get the gameplay out of the way, because the gameplay just became kind of a slog. Like, I knew what I was in for. And I knew what I had to do, and I didn't really feel like doing it anymore.
Do you think it goes on way too long? Because I've heard it's like about a 20-hour game, and I feel like, you know, Uncharted's are all maybe 6 hours or something, 6 or 8 hours at the most. They're not that long.
I that's the thing. I think the story kind of moves things along. Like, I mean, I found that I got a lot more interested in the game in the second half. I think it's a much better game in the second half, just because they introduce other characters and they take, you know, Joel and Ellie to other places. It's not just all Joel and Ellie, because the first half of the game is very much, you know, Joel being the, you know, sort of disapproving, silent, you know, father figure sort of thing to Ellie, who, you know, he doesn't really want to get too close to her. And so pretty much it's just those two running through, you know, these ruined cities. You go from Boston to Pittsburgh. And then you go out west, but kind of moving through all of these different cities, these cityscapes and city environments. And, you know, Ellie is kind of wisecracking and Joel is sort of like, let's just keep moving, you know, and that's the entire first half of the game. So
wait, they start in Boston? Really?
They start in Boston. Yep.
Why does everyone have a Southern accent?
Because Boston's in the South. Obviously.
I mean, I like it. I think the voices are great. I love hearing the accents, but I would have thought like Nashville maybe.
Yeah, I don't.
Nobody starts in Nashville.
Nashville's a cool city.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't think that Joel is actually from Boston. I think that's just kind of where he winds up. I think he's originally from Texas, if I recall.
Yeah, I would believe that.
Yeah. Yeah, he's originally from Texas.
But then the woman in the beginning, she has one. And anyway, sorry, I don't want to dwell on it. It was just that's really caught me off weird when you said Boston. I was like, no one in this game sounds like they're from Boston.
But yeah, I mean, is it a really good game? Absolutely. It's definitely worth playing through. I'm glad I played through it. Would I play through it again? Probably not.
Are you like excited about this DLC that's coming out pretty soon? Or maybe it just came out.
I'm neutral on it. I'll probably get it. if I feel like playing it again. You know, it's just I'm curious about the story that's told, because the story is really good. I mean, the cutscenes are absolutely amazing. I mean, but that's nothing. If anybody's just played the Uncharted games, the cutscenes are better than the Uncharted ones. But I mean, it's really good in the sense, I mean, the characters are really interesting. Just, I mean, all that stuff is really, really, really good. But I just felt like, you know, the gameplay just kind of slogs on at the end, much like I would say about Uncharted. I mean, at the end of Uncharted 3, I was like, all right, I get it. I have to kill a room full of guys. I have to sit here, and I can't move forward until I kill them all. Well, guess what? That's exactly what you do in Last of Us as well. You know, whether or not you're killing them with, you know, a baseball bat or a gun, or stabbing them, sneaking up behind them and killing them, slicing their throat, whatever, you still have to kill everybody to move forward to the next area. So that's that. And, you know, does that wear kind of thin near the end? Yeah. Is it a good game? Yeah, it's really good. But as far as all of this, you know, best game of this gen, I don't know. To me, it sticks too close to the Uncharted formula for me to say that. It evolves what was already there, rather than being anything to me that's truly groundbreaking beyond perhaps in the storytelling aspect of it, or, you know, the cutscene aspect of it.
Yeah, but when a game's 20 hours long, I'm not going to make that just on story. Like, I have to find the gameplay really motivating, or at least, like in the case of maybe a JRPG, the gameplay has to, like, kind of stay out of the way and be kind of addictive. It doesn't have to be super deep or complicated, but, like, it has to be something that's not going to annoy you. And, like, definitely I had that problem with Uncharted 3. I was totally sick of playing it by the end. And the story payoff in Uncharted 3 is total bullshit by the end anyway. I'm sure Last of Us is a lot better in that regard. But
well, I don't really agree with that. I mean, I've heard a lot said about the ending, about how the ending is, you know, it's sparked a lot of controversy, or at least a lot of people have discussed the ending, and I didn't like the ending at all. I don't feel like there's really any payoff with it. I'm not going to spoil it or anything, but I was just like, wow, I played 20 hours just for that?
Whoa.
Okay. Sure. That was kind of a waste of my time. But,
wow.
Yikes. Yeah. I was definitely interrupted on The Last of Us by the PS4 launch, because now anytime I'm not playing Nintendo, I'm probably playing PS4 and not PS3. But I will be going back to it for sure very soon. Especially once all my PS4 newness wears off and I find out there's nothing new coming out on that system for 3 more months, it'll be very easy to go back to PS3. So what else have you been playing with, man?
Well, just let me say one more thing before the internet erupts about the ending. You know, just to clarify that statement a bit, you know, kind of the ending that I had an ending that I thought it would be, and I was like, no, that ending's too cliche. They're going to do something else, because I'd heard that there was kind of like a twist at the end. Yeah, I was like, there's no way they're going to do my ending, because that ending is too cliche. But what I found was that my ending, for me, actually would have been more interesting and probably more unexpected than the ending that they actually provide for you.
Oh, okay. So maybe for me and other people, maybe it's better just to go in it with a completely open mind, blank space. Don't try to predict what's going to happen.
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay, cool. So what else you been playing?
Well, I did pick up a Vita. Because as anybody that's been following any of the sales, you know, on Black Friday and everything, I got mine before Black Friday, but there were some crazy Black Friday sales. So just been...
They're practically giving it away.
They are. I mean, this thing, I mean, you can get this
Please
thing.
Please take a Vita.
Yeah. I mean, this thing is regularly, I'm seeing, you know, bundles for $180. Like the Walking Dead bundle was like $180. I got mine for $170. And, you know, I've seen it for $156 in some places. Like, it's just crazy.
That's like a 3DS level price drop, just not as early. But that system launched at $250, so it's come down a lot. And the memory cards are cheaper now too. And I saw some really good deals on those over the weekend too.
Yeah, I got a 32 gig card for $40.
Oh man,
which is crazy.
You did this right.
Yes, I did it as cheap as possible. And that's the thing. It's, you know, could I probably afford this? No, not really. But I was like, I'm not going to see these deals again for a while, so. You know, I wanted to jump in. And I mean, I'm really enjoying it so far. I really like Vita. I'm actually pleasantly surprised at how much I enjoy it. So, you know, I have a PS Plus subscription. So, you know, I downloaded right off the bat. You can download, even with an 8 gig card, actually. An 8 gig card fits a surprising amount of games. I downloaded Wipeout, Uncharted, Gravity Rush, Hotline Miami, and Super Stardust, which I picked up afterwards. But I mean, everything but Stardust was free off of PS Plus, and those are all really good games. Probably not. I mean, I think this is a problem with Vita overall, is that none of those are really things that will necessarily sell it.
They're B-pillar titles.
Well, but yeah, but when you add them all together and you make them effectively free for most of the people who own the system, it's insane. It's so weird buying a system and having so many good games on it, like, immediately without you having to buy anything else.
Here's the business downside of that, which is those are the games you're most likely to buy when you get a Vita. Now you have this thing and you're not buying games for it.
I don't care. I mean,
yeah, it's like,
as an owner, I realize you don't care.
I'm just saying it's a weird business proposition they put themselves
in.
Yeah,
totally. Yep. Totally weird. Yeah.
Well, I think that just shows you how poorly it was doing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, before a few months ago, these games weren't selling anyway. And I think I think what they're doing is very logical. They're saying, look, we can't sell the games that are currently in development, like Tearaway and other stuff that's coming out next year, that they're actually spending significant money on. We will never make our budget back on those games if there aren't more of these systems on the shelves. And the games that already came out for the system clearly aren't selling it to people. So why don't we give those away for free to get people to buy the system, and then maybe we can convince them to buy the upcoming games where we can actually make some real money on it. You know, it's being not precious about their catalog, which of course Nintendo has a very, very different view on. But I will say in the past few years, Nintendo has become more willing to give away games with systems. You see them now doing it with New Super Mario Bros. U plus Super Luigi U. And then you've also got, even back on the first Wii, they started giving away Wii Sports and Wii Sports Resort. I mean, for a lot of people, you may never need to buy another game for that system. If that's what you want to do with it, that's everything. You know, you might buy a controller, but I mean, they've gotten, I think, in bundling and stuff like that much better. But Sony, just for the ridiculous avalanche of digital content that you get right away, it's just crazy.
Yeah, I mean, and they just released for PS Plus Soul Sacrifice this week, I think, or last week. So, I mean, that's another big game that I don't really know much about, but it's by, I think it's, I forget who did it. Is it Capcom?
It's the guy who used to be at Capcom, the Inafune.
Yeah.
It's his company. And he's doing Mighty No. 9 now. But yeah, that game before Tearaway was probably the biggest Vita game release of the whole year. And they're now, what, 3-4 months after it first came out, they're giving it away for free.
With Tearaway, I'll probably wait until that eventually goes on PS Plus as well. So I don't know how much their business model is actually backfiring, because now I just figured that everything will wind up on PS Plus for free eventually. But
like, I think because of the timing of that with this big hardware spike that they're going to get, I think they might actually wait a lot longer on that. But what they probably will do is do some kind of holiday sale, like right around Christmas week. And you might get it for like 25% off or something if you have PS Plus. And I actually bought Tearaway the day it came out, because it was my favorite game of E3 this year. I mean, I don't know that I ever really talked about it much on the show, but the Tearaway demo blew me away. And this is from someone who really does not like Little Big Planet whatsoever. So I was very excited for it. And then the reviews are just lavish, you know. I mean, everybody loves this game. So I was totally in right from the beginning. And I think it's only $30 anyway. 30 or 40, I don't know, but it's not crazy expensive, and I'm totally happy to support that kind of game. So I bought it right off, but I haven't played it yet. I think
the one thing with that game is that it plays to the strength of the Vita, which is its touchscreen. I'm actually really, really impressed by how great the touchscreen is.
It makes you immediately realize how shitty the 3DS one is.
Yes. I mean, it is really, really nice. It just really works really smoothly.
It's so responsive and fast.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to mash on the screen to make it accept your input. You can just barely touch it. And it works in all the UI. You can use either the touchscreen or the joystick almost completely consistently through the operating system. And 3DS is terrible about that. I mean, DS was probably even worse, but 3DS is still very bad. There's just certain things you should be able to do on both that you can't. And it actually makes you switch back and forth all the time, which is just so irritating. So I think Vita is, I mean, people complain about that that user interface on the home screen and how ugly it is, but I think it works fine.
Yeah, it's functional, you know. I mean, it's no worse than the XMB.
Yeah. it's better than that. It's really actually patterned after more it's like a more of an iPhone home screen, or even like the Wii channel system, where all the content is just laid out in these blocks in a two-dimensional array, and you can reorder them, you can create multiple pages, you can delete them from there. I think if you like the Wii channel menu, or even the Wii U channel menu, you'll be completely fine with the Vita operating system. It's very similar.
Yeah, and I mean, it works great with the touchscreen as well. You just flick through, and I mean, it's really good. The touchscreen on the back, I haven't really used it that much. In Uncharted, I think it's kind of used.
You're not going to use it much, except for the way.
Yeah, I mean, in Uncharted, they kind of go hog wild using it, to the point where it's like, you know, you pick up some artifact and you have to, you know, rub all of the dirt off of it.
Oh,
and you have
sake.
To rotate it with the touchscreen on the back.
What is this, Dr. Latrec's archaeological adventure? God damn.
They're kind of heavy-handed with it. It works well within the game. I mean, because, you know, he's going through all these ruins and finding artifacts and stuff. So it kind of works within the context of the game. But it's – come on, man. Like,
like a lot of Wii games and how they use motion control. It works in concept, but in execution, it's not actually fun to do at all. It's actually just irritating, and especially when it doesn't work correctly, like in that Uncharted game on Vita. A lot of those I found really irritating, because they're like the thing you're holding is already brown underneath the dirt, so you really can't tell where you've rubbed and where you haven't. And because the touchscreen is very sensitive, you actually really have to kind of get around the edges and stuff like that, and they don't fudge it all that much. So sometimes it's actually really hard to find the spot that you missed. The whole thing is just bad. It's a bad feature. The way it's used in that game, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, you have to finesse it way too much, and it just slows the game down. So
yeah, it's not fun. I mean, if it was actually fun to do, I'd be like, yeah, cool. I mean, but it's not. It's stupid. It's like a hacking mini game that is, you know, stupid and annoying, and you have to do it 1,000 times.
Yep. Now, the other thing I will say about the rear touchscreen is, the weird thing is I downloaded Final Fantasy VII as well, because I'd already bought that on PS3. So I was like, let's just put that – let's just see if I can, you know, download that already, because I was thinking, man, I really would like to play that on this. And sure enough, I could just download it straight to Vita, no problem. But so what they don't do is they don't turn that rear touchscreen off for PS1 games, which I found out by playing this. And there's two of the menus in that game. I couldn't understand why – as soon as I open up the menu, I think it's the sell menu and the save game menu. So two critical menus. I thought this was a game-breaking bug. Every time I opened them up, and of course, I mean, I'm just holding it normally, you know, with my fingers on the back. Every time it would scroll all the way to the very end of the list, and I couldn't get it to stop. And so I'm like, what the hell is this? So I had to go online to figure out if this was a bug or not. And they're like, oh, no, take your hands off of the rear touchscreen. And I was, sure enough, that worked.
Yeah, it's because they use the rear touch to do R2 and L2, because the Vita only has two shoulder buttons, and all the DualShock controllers have four. So they use the touch panel, and I don't know for sure if you can reconfigure that stuff.
I don't think you can. Yeah, so we'll see. I'll see if there's actually – because there's nothing in the Vita settings. I don't know if there's anything from within the game settings for the PS1 game once you're into the emulator. I don't know, but – it just seems weird that they wouldn't turn that off by default, because it's pretty confusing, you know? And the thing is, you have no idea that you're even doing it, you know? Because it's a PS1 game. Why the heck would it be configured to use a rear touchscreen, you know? It just doesn't make any sense. But
I mean, for my short time with the system, I just don't like that it's back there. Like, I feel like I hit it a bunch of times just trying to hold the system.
Well, in most of the software, it's completely irrelevant whether you touch it or not. I mean, that's very few games actually use it. I think the only way it really works is in something like Tearaway, where you use it so much that you never really take your fingers off the back touch. Like, it becomes part of the way that you hold the system. And it's not uncomfortable, but you're always cognizant of it. The problem is when you need to be cognizant of it only sometimes. And that's when I think I find it to get very confusing. And that's the case, like, I've been playing Rezogun over remote play for my PS4. And there are functions on R2 and L2 that I don't use very often. But when I need to, I actually have to kind of stop and think about, how do I do that? Because it's just not very intuitive to use the back touch. And the other thing is, the back touch, I don't know if it's like filtering some of the input so that you don't overuse it, or it's trying to like you know, ascertain when you meant to do that based on how long you hold it or how hard you, I have no idea what it's doing, but it doesn't always work when you touch the back panel. And so luckily in Resogun, it's not that critical for how I play the game, but for some games, it's going to make it completely unplayable. And I would imagine on PS1 emulation, the same thing. I mean, it's just, it's going to work fine for a lot of games, but every now and then you find something that use R2 and L2 a lot, and it's going to be completely irritating and pretty much unplayable.
That's one of the big strengths, I think, of Vita is the fact, especially if you have a PS3 and you've downloaded all kinds of, you know, PS1 games and stuff like that. If you want to play these games on the go, hey, you can do it. And they're the same quality that you would get if you played it on PS3. So it's awesome for that. I mean, if you want to, you know, backlog dive, then the Vita is with your PS3. I mean, then the Vita is pretty much the way to go.
If you have any PSP games that you bought digitally for your PSP, and a lot of people did that, those also will port over, and those all work as far as I know. As far as I've tried, at least, they all work fine.
Anyways, Vita is cool if you have a deep PS3 backlog.
Is that what we were talking about?
It's really good. I'm actually really, really impressed by it.
Flights of Fancy. Okay, James, are you ready for new business?
I've been working on the Wii U library that I've sort of amassed, such as that system can have a library. So I didn't actually indulge in any Black Friday dalliances because I still had the 3 Wii U games I got when Target did their buy 2 get 1 free sale. So I had worked Wonderful 101 pretty hard. I haven't talked about it on the show because I know that that game inspires a lot of passions. It didn't do it for me, but I respect what the game's trying to do, so I didn't really have a lot to say about it. The next game I had opened up, and I just opened it up this week, was Rayman... Oh, fuck, what's this one
Legends.
Called?
Legends.
Legends, yeah. The last time I had played Rayman is when they released that demo back in, what, February? Like, a long time ago. And I remember really enjoying the demo, and then when they pushed it back on, well, sucks to be them. So I finally got around to playing it, and I find that game is a remarkably capable game of just eating time. I sat down to play for a few minutes and ended up playing for about 3 hours.
Nice.
And clearing essentially an entire world's worth of stages with all of the things to find. It's one of those games where as I got closer and closer to the music level, I'm like, well, I'll just keep going a little bit more. And then I finally hit the point and I'm like, oh, okay, I played the whole stage. So it's a really satisfying game. It's very, very brisk, which is a nice feeling when you're just trying to get through stuff pretty quickly. I've spent some time with the challenges. I'm fairly convinced that people are cheating. I just don't know how. The weekly challenge right now is basically like run 300 meters. And I have a silver with like 25 seconds. And then I see that to get like the highest tier, I have to do it in like 12. And I don't comprehend how somebody did that.
Yeah, people came up with all sorts of little tricks to improve their scores with the free app and like trying to hit... as you start, because if you actually punch, then you go a little bit faster initially.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I hammer punch. Like, I've got to the point where, like, I knew when to hit punch the entire course.
Okay. And also, I think that people who play two players have some sort of advantage.
Oh.
Like, at least for, like, the Murphy levels or something like that.
Oh, yeah, this was just a straight-up run. I don't understand. I don't understand at all. It's...
Why are you doing a 100-yard dash in Rayman Legends? That sounds incredibly boring. You just run in a straight line?
No, it's platforming. You have to go 300 meters, but it's got all kinds of, like, there's jumps, and there's some spikes you have to avoid, and there's some vines you have to swing on. There's some things like the air currents where you actually don't want to use them because you go really slow through them. So it's a lot of, like, okay, at this exact spot, I need to jump to hit that bounce to accelerate a little bit. It's a lot of that kind of stuff.
Do you know if those are like distinct levels or are they just like remixes from the rest of the game?
They've got to be distinct.
That's cool.
Because there's no way they would have been a whole level. It's only 300 meters long. And it's a ton of stuff just jammed in real fast. So it's fun, and it's fun to watch, you know, these ghosts, which just you see the ghosts of other players who are roughly in your comparable time zone based on your best record. And there's something really invigorating about seeing that you're in the lead of these ghosts and just like, don't screw up. Like, if you can get all the other ghosts off the screen, you're so far ahead of them. That's a really good feeling. So I've been having a lot of fun with that game. I think it's a remarkably well put together platformer, even though I'm playing it single player.
I think in general, you do not want to play that game multiplayer except for the Murphy levels. That's my opinion. But I mean, I would not want an extra character on there slapping me as I'm trying, because the game gets very, very difficult. And I mean, the multiplayer is kind of fun in a, like a, you know, people being shitty to each other way. But if you want to actually get through the game, it's worse than the, you know, the Mario games, I think, in terms of the multiplayer makes it dramatically more difficult. That's always been my experience, at least.
You know, I enjoy it. I'll probably dump some more time in there in the next few days just to sort of work through the game. It's real easy, but obviously I'm at the beginning of the game, so that's fine. I'm not too worried about it. The other game that I have devoted time to this week, and in fact have cleared, is Zelda Link Between Worlds. And I don't like that game. I mean, I'll just be honest. I don't understand the near universal acclaim this game is getting. I'm dumbfounded by it, to be honest.
I know that feeling.
It kind of sucks when, yeah, you're just like outside looking in and just like you don't get it. You want to enjoy a game and it's just not happening.
I understand that a big purpose of the game was to maybe slaughter a couple sacred cows, get some extra changes out of the whole format for Zelda, but I feel like a lot of the stuff they did just didn't work for me. The idea of giving you the items just whenever you want them and making no order to the dungeons, in theory, I understand why you would try it, but what I found in practice is that most of the dungeons, well, that means that the dungeon, they don't know what order you played the dungeons in, with, you know, some minor exceptions. And it means that all the dungeons end up being at pretty much the exact same level of difficulty, the exact same puzzle structure, and it feels like there's no real progression from dungeon to dungeon. It's just sort of samishness, which is disappointing because you've gotten stronger in every dungeon as you've picked up hearts and upgraded items, and you've gotten better at the game. So it becomes, Link increasingly becomes the Terminator. And there's really nothing that can be done to stop him. The puzzles in the game are really, really brutally simplistic, even by some of the more recent Zelda standards. I mean, there are way too many rooms that the only puzzle is effectively, find all the pots we hid buttons under and press them. I mean, by Zelda standards, there's a lot of these.
There's definitely more of those than in A Link to the Past.
Yeah, and I find those to be utterly boring because there's no challenge in them. It's just, hey, did you think to break all the pots? I bet you did. So they're not particularly interesting, and I found that the dungeons themselves are just really, really easy and short. And cruising through, I would say no dungeon, potentially even the last dungeon, took me more than 40 minutes.
Now, as a portable game, do you think that's maybe more acceptable? Or do you just think that's always too short for Zelda?
I think for a Zelda game, if the longest dungeon is under 40 minutes, there's a problem. I can understand that if the majority are under 40 minutes, that's fine. But the fact that even the boss's dungeon is really only, about 7 rooms. And then 4 bosses you fight again.
See, this is, I mean, definitely a matter of taste, because I remember playing Spirit Tracks, which a lot of people felt had, you know, really good dungeons, like really complex.
Oh, I think they're amazing dungeons.
I found those, and see, I had the opposite reaction there. I found those dungeons to be irritating and tedious, and they took at least twice as long as I felt was appropriate, especially for a portable Zelda game, but really any Zelda game. So, you know, it's just very different. I guess we're looking for different things out of Zelda.
Right. I mean, to me, what those dungeons in Spirit Tracks did is, or not Spirit Tracks, in Phantom Hourglass, and to an extent Spirit Tracks, what they did is they said, we have this game that is an extreme departure from the franchise. Because, I mean, we talk about how, they're really changing a lot of stuff in Link Between Worlds. But Spirit Tracks, they completely redesigned how you play a Zelda game. They said, you can play a Zelda game using only the touchscreen. You can do it. Believe us. And they did it. I mean, you absolutely can play a Zelda experience using only a stylus.
Yeah, I mean, the dungeons definitely take advantage of that interface in that they make you take notes and draw things. And, you know, I thought that stuff was amusing, but very gimmicky and did not reveal a new depth of puzzle solving. It just kind of gave me new kinds of puzzles I hadn't seen before, but I felt within that paradigm, they were very easy. They were very simple. And some of them I just found kind of crass, you know, where it just like makes you write down numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4 over a certain pattern and then bring it up later. I just think that's lame. Like, it's not even fun to do.
Yeah, I can understand that. But to me, what the phrase you had in there was, it gave me puzzles I hadn't seen before.
True. I mean, no one could argue that Phantom Hourglass isn't fresh.
In Link Between Worlds, I don't remember a single puzzle I haven't seen some variation of before. I mean, the difference is, the biggest one is, well, you can use the hammer to go up, but in previous Zelda games, you just went down. So it's not really that big of a difference. You fell into the hole as opposed to bouncing up on top of it. To me, this game didn't feel fresh at all, and I think the best place to sum it up is the bosses. This is some of the laziest boss design in Nintendo history. And that's a big statement, because every single one of these bosses is from another game.
So you use the hammer to go up in the air and bonk them all on the head 3 times.
No, you don't even do that. Most of them you just cyber demon it. You hit it till it dies. I mean, it's these bosses are abominations. All right, let's go to the example. There's the one that's just a series of it's kind of like a snake with the balls getting made of balls that gets smaller and smaller to the end, and the tail's red.
It's the third boss from A Link to the Past.
It's in A Link to the Past. It's also in Link's Awakening. There's the one where you have to pull the bubbles off of it using the hook shot and then hit it.
It's the same dungeon that as in A Link to the Past.
It's also in Ocarina of Time in a very similar sort of form. This game just feels really super repetitive. It feels the one thing they add to the game, the ability to merge into the wall, I feel like they underuse, or they just use kind of the same way. It's a hookshot replacement the vast majority of the time it's used.
Hmm.
Whereas they've got this mechanic where they can, as you say, we have made this a properly 2D experience. And it didn't feel like they used it that much. They use it, the only time I felt like it really got used in a unique way, without spoiling it, is in the last boss battle.
So what I've enjoyed the most out of the merge feature, I think, are the places where there are moving platforms that are kind of folding and going back and forth, and you merge onto a surface in order to get up to a higher place that you normally wouldn't get to. I thought that stuff, it's very three-dimensional, and it's a little bit like Escher-like, you know, and that it kind of warps your sense of the physical spatial relationships between parts of the environment. I thought that stuff was really exciting. A lot of the other stuff, I think glorified hookshot is a kind of a weird way to approach it, but I see where you're going, and it effectively it just gets you across a gap, right?
Yep.
In a different way.
Yep.
I think that's fair, although in a lot of cases it'll get you across a gap that is so big and twisted and uneven that you wouldn't even look at it as a gap. You know, I like some of the caves where you can go outside, maybe some of the dungeons actually, you can go outside to the outside wall, and you can like go all the way around the building and get to a weird place that you couldn't even see from the point where you departed.
Sure.
And that's not something the hookshot could ever do. It's almost like it's almost like being able to fly, because it lets you test the boundaries of the 3D environment that you're in. And that's not really what hookshot does. In fact, the hookshot in this game is damn near useless.
Oh, it's entirely useless. It's used in one dungeon. That's it.
Well, there's some stuff on the overworld, but it's very sparse, and you've seen all that before.
Because they give you these items specifically for one dungeon, and they don't know what order you have them, every item feels like the spinner from Twilight Princess. It's used in this one dungeon, and then outside there's maybe one place to get a piece of heart to use it, and that's it. Because they don't even know that you have it when you get to the last dungeon, because you could have died and lost them all. There's a couple items where in the last dungeons you have to have this item to proceed any further in this dungeon.
Most people by that point should have all of them anyway.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because, I mean, here's the other sad reality. I never died in the game.
You're too good.
My end state is 13 hours, 0 deaths.
Honestly, do you think you would enjoy this game more if it had like a hard mode available right from the beginning?
If the hard mode meant that some of the puzzles were harder, yes.
That's probably wishful thinking.
I know. So there is an interview, and I unfortunately, I don't have it in front of me, that was done with some of the designers on this game prior to it coming out. And they were talking about how they focus tested Zelda puzzles with gamers who consider themselves to be, mid to advanced video game players who haven't played Zelda before, who are younger. And just the sheer lack of understanding of how the Zelda stuff works, the examples of stuff they were talking about seeing. There was one where they said what they did was they put them in front of the very first Zelda game, Zelda 1, on the NES, and it was just the dungeons, just in succession, no overworld. And if you died, you immediately continued in the room you died in. And only a handful of people made it through all four dungeons they put up there.
So effectively, they took out the combat risk, right? So that would be more about navigating, finding the secret passages,
right. And,
pushing the
and
blocks.
Even
to go
then,
down the
they
stairs.
Still people were still struggling really badly to get through it. And one of the most terrifying examples I read was they killed this player. I think he was like 12. Killed the boss, and then the heart shows up, and he starts hitting it with his sword. And somebody finally went and asked him what he was doing, and he thought it was like the second form of the boss.
I would love for them to release this weird like hack version of Zelda on the eShop so I could like take it to my grandmother and have her try it, like this weird go around and do your own test cases with people.
I'll dig the interview up and put it in the comments in the talkback. It's I want to say it was with IGN. It's depressing. And to me, the combat in Zelda is what it is. For me, it's about the puzzles, which is why I really, really love Phantom Hourglass, because it has some really good puzzle design in the dungeons. Whereas for this game, I'm just kind of like,
All right, well, you're very entitled to your opinion. I'm not going to try to prove you wrong or anything. I just want to let people know that I completely disagree with James on Link Between Worlds. I'm loving it, like most people, to be fair, who've played it. Most people are really loving it. There are a handful of detractors, but I'm finding it incredibly enjoyable. Of course, James and I have different backgrounds with Zelda. I mean, James, you're more of a Link's Awakening person over a Link to the Past, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, obviously, a lot of people love both, but I do think there are two distinct camps of people who vastly prefer one over the other. And for me, I've always amazed that they did Link's Awakening on Game Boy. I think it's just incredibly impressive for its platform, but it is not remotely one of my favorite Zelda games, and it never has been. I've always thought Link to the Past was way better, way up more out my alley, and it just felt more like a world. It had a much better sense of place, whereas Link's Awakening is like a set of puzzle rooms. Even the overworld, I mean, we've talked about this, but even the overworld is kind of like a series of puzzles that are just very, you have to be very meticulous to even get from one place to the other. And Link to the Past is much more open. I mean, people forget, people keep talking about Link Between Worlds and how so significant it is that you can play the dungeons out of order. You could do that in a Link to the Past with some of them. Once you get to the Dark World, there's a number of them you can do in whatever order you want. And in fact, the whole setup is very similar to the way it is in this game.
And to clear up a point here, you actually cannot play any dungeon. Once you get to the seven dungeons, you cannot play any of them at the beginning when you want. There are a couple that are prerequisites for other ones.
Well, you need the sand rod to get into one of them, and
you need like the sand rod to get a Titan Mint and the Titan Mint to get into another one.
I would say it's about as nonlinear as Link to the Past. Now, admittedly, that would make it the most nonlinear Zelda game since A Link to the Past, which is 21 years old, I guess. But this has been done before, in particular. So I question, actually, whether this is really like a new direction for the series, or if in aping A Link to the Past and sort of repeating that formula for a new generation, if A Link Between Worlds is getting a lot of credit for being way more like innovative and revolutionary than it actually is. It's just actually very faithful to the way that A Link to the Past was.
I think it's entirely possible.
The only difference is that you could explore the world instantly in this game versus Link to the Past, where you still had to get the items out of the dungeon.
That's fair, yeah. But I guess I remember in A Link to the Past, I never felt like there were tons of places in the overworld where you needed the dungeon items. Other than the hammer, that's probably the number one.
And like we just talked about, in A Link's Awakening, it's the opposite. There's a lot of places you just can't get to until you get to a certain point.
All right, well, it is a fascinating game. I hope John and Guillaume are going to get to play it pretty soon. And
all a matter of time, my friend.
Yep, pretty soon.
Yeah, I would love to get some more opinions on this because I love talking about this game and I love that people are talking about Zelda. So I'm going to wrap up new business by talking about Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag. I'm playing it on PS4. I waited for that version because I knew it would be the prettiest one and I thought it would be kind of a nice meaty
game resolution
to have
whore
at the launch. You know, I do like resolution.
Well, it's funny, John, because resolution isn't really the issue. It's all over the place depending on what version you get. It's really more just the detail.
But the PS4 version does look great. But of course, this game is available on Wii U, and I know our friend Carl is playing it on Wii U, probably some other people. Again, I mean, I played Assassin's Creed 3 on Wii U, and I thought it was a very good version. It was no more buggy than any other version, and they did patch it a number of times. So, I mean, they certainly maintained it along with the other ones. And I don't think the Wii U version lacked any features at all from Assassin's Creed 3. It actually made really nice use of the gamepad. And of course, you know, the same would be true of Assassin's Creed 4. It's just not as exclusive anymore because with AC4, you can do a lot of that gamepad stuff on your PS4 and Vita if you do have that combination, including remote play, which works pretty well from my experience. Anyway, Assassin's Creed 4 is really good. I don't know if y'all heard. You know, keep in mind, I really like 3 a lot more than most people. So for me, 4 is definitely better, as I expected, and it definitely has more of the things I like and less of the things I didn't like in 3, but it's not like 1,000 times better for me. It's like maybe, you know, twice as good. So, you know, but I mean, the good thing is everybody seems to be on board this time. I mean, I think 3 definitely had its issues. They were okay for me. The biggest problem probably with 3 is that the open world aspect to it wasn't that fulfilling. You had these two or three major cities and then this big kind of vague frontier area that connected them. And, you know, when the geography is as familiar as New England, that doesn't really make sense. It just really kind of breaks the...
Well, especially because New England's not really that open, even then.
Yeah, so it's very strange. It's like you get out and you run for 5 minutes north and now you're in Boston. It's like, that's stupid, you know?
Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, I don't think people liked Noah as much either.
Who?
Isn't that his name, the main character of that game? O'Connor, excuse me, yeah. The only people really cared about him that much as a character.
Yeah, I mean, I thought he had a really interesting background. You know, like the setup for Connor was really good. He came from an interesting place and he had an interesting set of circumstances around him, and especially his interactions with his father, which continued throughout the game and were by far the most interesting aspect for me. That father-son thing was just very, very interesting because it's almost like the adventures of Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader, you know, where they're like, sometimes they're friends, sometimes they're enemies. They have a very hostile, but very deep and familiar connection with each other. That was very cool. But yeah, I mean, Connor himself on his own, as an adult is not a very expressive or interesting character, just in the way that he speaks and his actions. He's not characterized that well for that part of it. He just has a cool background.
And I think coming off Ezio, that might
yeah,
be.
Yeah, I guess I always felt Ezio was really overrated too. I found him pretty annoying.
Oh, Ezio is so fucking over the top.
So in AC4, you play Connor's grandfather, who is a British man who has ended up in the Caribbean, and he's a straight up pirate. And I mean, this game doesn't play around with that. They don't kind of tease that he's a pirate. They don't insinuate that he's a pirate. He is a pirate-ass pirate from the very beginning of the game. The way he becomes an assassin is he kills an assassin and steals his clothes. That's how much of a pirate he is. He has no training whatsoever as an assassin. And so it really does feel like a very strange excursion for the series. You're not playing as Desmond Miles when you're out of the Animus. You're just kind of this generic, nameless character. And it even switches to a first-person perspective. So it's not a third-person action game at all when you're out of the Animus. You just kind of float around this building and talk to people and hack terminals and stuff. And that stuff is interesting because the context for this game is very strange. I'm not going to go into it because it's complicated to explain it. But it is interesting. It's very different from the first three games, or the first five games, I guess.
Whatever you want to count it as.
But, you know, most of the time, of course, you're spending in the Caribbean, and the way you get around is by ship. And that's the best thing about this game is, the, you know, what excited me the most before it came out. And it's what you'll spend a ton of your time doing is sailing in these ships, doing ship battles, exploring, setting anchor at islands and going off and picking up a couple things and then jumping right back on the ship. I mean, you really do kind of live on the ship for most of the game. And that stuff, it handles so great. It looks superb. The music is great. The pirates and your crew will sing songs for you. It's just so, so crazy. The weather changes constantly. And there's always something to do. There's always something nearby to pick up some cargo or rescue someone who's shipwrecked. There's always a little island with a treasure map on it or a treasure chest that you can go dig up. There's always, you know, neutral or hostile ships in the area who you can fight and try to pillage. And a huge part of the economy of this game, the way that you buy things is you go out and you blow up other ships who are just minding their own business because you are a pirate. And that stuff is shockingly fun. And it's freeing in a way. Like there's a sense of lawlessness to what you're doing. And like moral ambiguity or just actually moral outrage maybe at the stuff that you're doing that I haven't felt since like the early GTA games when they went to 3D. You know, I mean, I've become sort of numb to that stuff, especially when you see it satirized the way it is in Saints Row. But in Assassin's Creed Black Flag, you are an outlaw of, you know, a much earlier generation, and there's no one who's going to stop you. And you live a hard life, and you do bad things to good people. And there's also all this assassin stuff built into the story, but, you know, most of what you're doing in and around the game is just going around being a pirate. And, like, it must be the best pirate game ever. You know, I know like people like, what is it, Sid Meier's Pirates, like the old PC game. I don't know much about it, but this is a very big, ambitious, action-y pirate game on a scale that I don't think anyone's ever even attempted, and it's really good. And of course, it's pretty easy to draw comparisons to Wind Waker, because you're on this ship a lot, and the ocean is humongous, and there's tons of islands to go explore, and there's really fun stuff to find. And a lot of the stuff that you go out and find when you explore the Caribbean are like upgrades for you and your ship. And so there's this constant sense of progression. You're getting better. And then once you do that, now you can maybe go to a part of the ocean that was too dangerous before. So there is a lot of Zelda smeared all over this, and I think it does the game very good. I think it fits it well, and it makes the game more addictive, more fun. In just a way that, you know, like in Assassin's Creed 3, once I realized that the frontier is actually not that big and it's actually mostly empty and you spend the whole time just running constantly or maybe riding your horse, I just usually wanted to get through it as quickly as possible. And I was not interested in exploring it. I didn't really think it was that much fun. And they have, I mean, just that overworld aspect, they have done so much with it in Black Flag. They've just completely turned the whole thing on its head. It's also almost perfectly seamless. So every island in the game that you can explore is just like in Wind Waker, but it almost never stops for a loading screen. There's only just a couple of places. And that is just, they've created this enormous world that is really exciting to plot a course, to go out and just find things. And there's so many different little activities that they've sprinkled all over this world. And most of them I've tried are actually fun. And most of them I want to keep doing. And that has not been the case in previous Assassin's Creed games. So I think they've done a lot of very smart things here. I'm pretty amazed that they would turn this around in 1 year after 3. It definitely does not feel like an expansion pack to AC3. It is a very new and very different game.
Does it feel like maybe they had ideas for a pirate game and just said, eh, fuck it, let's just make an Assassin's Creed game? Because when I look at it, I don't see Assassin's Creed until like they put the cloak on him and like, well, no, he's running from trees, see?
You know, I think that's fair, but there are certainly, I mean, there are parts of the game where you go into like a town and you are climbing up on buildings and stalking people or,
sure.
You know, so I mean, there's a lot of it that is very familiar. Some of that stuff actually is my least favorite part of the game. Like there's a lot of stealth missions where you're hiding in the bushes, killing people. And if you mess up, you have to start over, and it just gets way too Metal Gear Solid for my taste. And,
it just feels like they were way more devoted to the context of this particular Assassin's Creed game than they have been in previous ones.
Yeah, but I don't think that's an anomaly, and I don't think that speaks to some kind of like huge cover-up where they turned like a non-Assassin's Creed game into one. I don't think this is a Star Fox Adventures situation. I think this is them realizing when you have such a rich and fertile setting that most people have never really done before in a video game, you really should go all in. And I think what they're learning is this is what they should have been doing in the first place. I mean, one of the great things about this franchise is that they do set their games in interesting places where you don't normally play other video games. And so the location is very much a character, and it's very much a huge part of the appeal. But they've always felt like a little plastic. Like you never feel like you really get deeply entrenched into the culture of these historic places or the storyline. And, you know, I think with 3, they made some strides in that area just because they set it in a recognizable, very familiar setting of the Revolutionary War. And they threw you up against characters like, you know, Ben Franklin and George Washington. And all of a sudden, there's way more context for this. And again, that was one of the things I actually liked about that game, is it just got so crazy with the weird missions they were giving you that actually felt like they meant something. And in this game, I think in a different way, but I think they're going just way farther in that direction. They're saying, look, if we're putting a game in the Caribbean, let's not make it feel like the Middle East with a different skin on the environment. Let's make it feel like we're actually in the Caribbean and you're doing things that you would have done. And so I think this is probably the new formula. And as this franchise moves forward, which of course it will, I think they're going to go to this length with future games as well. I hope it's 2 years from now and not 1 year from now. But I'm super happy with Assassin's Creed 4. I played a ton of it last night, and it was very easy to get back into after a couple of weeks off for Mario and Zelda. And there's so much to do. It's a humongous game. I would highly recommend it. All right, well, that is going to wrap up new business, and we've got lots more games to talk about, but they'll have to wait until next week because we are committed to taking this break, and when we come back, we're going to take your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
This week we have a feature, an ongoing feature, by our various editors, the top Wii U games of the first year of the Wii U.
Yes, 10 games came out on Wii U this year. Go see what they were.
That's too easy of a joke. Please, quickly disregard our top 10 for this year and write your own in the comments for this article.
Yeah, that's a winner.
Yeah.
All right, well, this week we also have, of course, a review of Super Mario 3D World by Andrew Brown. And, of course, you know, like most Nintendo fans out there, he really likes it. But find out what particular wrinkles they've added to the Mario formula that, in his mind, put this one way, way, way over the top.
I can't help myself, because this week we have yet another Disney Infinity good idea, bad idea from Becky and Kim. Every time they write about these, I talk about them, because this time they've decided to talk about Marvel characters. Kim thinks that Loki of the Thor franchise would be a great addition to the Disney Infinity Universe, whereas Becky thinks that adding ridiculous, over-the-top, ubermensch enemy Thanos from Guardians of the Galaxy wouldn't be.
Thanos, not Thanos.
Thanos. Fine. Apparently it's such a bad idea I can't bother to pronounce his name correctly. There we go.
All right, and finally this week we have a review, and it's sort of import review, of Bravely Default, a Flying Fairy. I guess they dropped the subtitle, but Bravely Default is out in
it's
Europe.
Stupid!
Yeah, well, Don Koopman reviewed the European version. Of course, it's in English for the first time, and this game will be coming to North America in February. Don gave it a 9.5. He thinks it's superb and has all kinds of wonderful things to say about it, including the online and Street Pass features, but especially the RPG gameplay systems and the story, which he says stays interesting all the way through. It's one of my most anticipated games of 2014 right now, and if you want a little preview of what you might be playing in North America in a couple of months, definitely go read Don's review. All right, and you can check out all of this great content and lots more over at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Yo, yo.
Welcome back to the show. It is time for listener mail, and Guillaume has the first email this week.
Yoshi1001 from Madison, Wisconsin writes, The soundtrack for Pokemon X and Y was recently released on iTunes, marking the first time a Pokemon game soundtrack has received a Western release since the Gotta Catch the Sound album, a compilation of music from Pokemon Snap and Stadium. The music seems to be doing quite well, around 5,000 sales. Additionally, more Pokemon game soundtracks are expected in 2014. This prompts a few questions for me. Will this lead to more game soundtracks being made available for purchase in the West? Which game soundtracks would you like to see come out? And will this raise the stature of video game in the larger music community?
I think the answer to the last one is no, because I don't know anybody who actively uses iTunes right now.
Oh, come on. It sold really well, at least briefly. I think there was a spike. You know, there's a pent-up demand for something like this, and the hardcore fans probably heard about it in advance, so they were all ready when it first released, and then, you know, it didn't sustain any sales because the actual market for this is pretty small. You know, it's one thing to say, I like video game music. It's another to seek it out at a store and pay money for it. And I think that's a significant gulf between those two things, actually. So, I mean, I like video game music, but I don't buy it. You know, if I might get a soundtrack every now and then with a Humble Bundle or something, but a lot of times with that stuff, I don't even play them. I don't even listen to them because I don't really listen to game music outside of actually playing the games and then stuff like radio trivia. I'm not going to throw it on in the car when I'm driving to work.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I'm probably most inclined, but I don't know that I've ever actually bought a soundtrack. I've bought versions of games that come with soundtracks, but I don't know that I was explicitly because of the soundtrack.
And would you play the soundtrack? I mean, do you actually use those?
Yeah, some of them. So I actually did listen pretty extensively to the soundtrack that came with my copy of Radiant Historia. Because it's really good.
It is good music.
Yeah.
It's not even the music from the game. It's sort of these piano arrangements that are performed really, really lovingly. So they just kind of work well musically.
Yeah. That's nice.
But I mean... saying raising the stature of the genre, it really depends heavily on what game we're talking about. There are games that have remarkably competent musical scores that have nothing to do with them being video game music. They're just really, really strong compositions.
Yeah. Well, there is a category in the Spike Game TV Game Awards or whatever the hell they call them. That they do. I think they're doing them actually around the time this episode comes out, because Reggie's going to show up there. But I think there is a category for music there, and that probably raises the awareness a little bit. You know, and then there's the DICE Awards, like in February. So, I mean, there's stuff, but outside of the existing video game, like what could you do to make people who don't even play video games listen to video game music?
Well,
that
I mean,
seems
what would you,
very difficult.
What can you do to make people who don't watch movies listen to movie soundtracks?
Right. I mean, why would you even try? It just seems unlikely that they would ever be interested, you know?
So, I mean, this is obviously a much bigger market, pun not intended, in Japan, where music soundtracks are regularly put, you know, in retail for games.
It's part of their cultural heritage, though. I mean, it's been happening for so long that they don't even think about it.
That's my point. I don't know that could ever really leave their... this very Japanese thing to do. Yeah. And in
and
a way...
This is Pokemon we're talking about here. It's not like it's some niche little series.
Right, and keep in mind, 5,000 people buying this thing, I mean, that's not even a percent of a percent of the people who buy
that's
Pokemon.
Like the number of copies of Pokemon they sold at a Walmart.
Yeah.
What's weird is in... and you can see this in a lot of games. In fact, a good example is X, whatever that game turns out to be. Nintendo, one of the very first people Nintendo announced was involved in the game was the composer, who in Japan is super hot right now because his music was on a bunch of really, really popular TV shows. Like, they hired him undoubtedly with the intention of selling a soundtrack later. But that's such a Japanese thing to do that I don't know that you could ever see that anywhere else.
Honestly, I could see... I don't know who published this Pokemon X and Y soundtrack. You know, someone very inventive and risky, I think, probably with their money, because it costs something to bring it over, right? You have to do the publishing fees, and you have to give a percentage to Apple if you sell it on iTunes.
Well, and you have to just like handle like things like trademarks.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of like business costs that go with this. So even if the soundtrack already exists in Japan, it's not free to bring it over here. But, you know, I bet 5,000 sales, I bet this thing made a profit for somebody. And I bet other people would say, you know, clearly there's at least like a hardcore niche group who would buy this stuff. And maybe also with all the indie games, a lot of them are doing soundtrack releases that are part of the Kickstarter, or they sell, I think you can actually sell soundtracks on Steam separately. So there is a marketplace for this stuff if you can find a way to market it. You know, if you can let people know, get them interested. And I could see, especially with the nostalgia factor, you know, doing stuff like Final Fantasy CDs, maybe Chrono Trigger or something like that. I mean, if they did that Chrono Trigger jazz remix album, I would buy it. And I bet a lot of people would, because that game's so beloved and famous, and it's been around forever. So it has the name recognition, you know, and then Kotaku puts up a story and we put up a story. And before you know it, maybe sell a few thousand copies, and that's enough to make it worth somebody's while. And it, if that took off and you had a, you heard of a few successful things like this, in other words, if Pokemon is not the one hit wonder, but if there's at least two or three other ones, I could see it becoming like this kind of mini market. That, you know, maybe it's the same people buying all of them, but that's enough to make it worth doing. I mean, I could see a number of them being released because of this thing. And that's why I wanted to read the email and kind of get it out there, because I think maybe this is the start of something. I don't equate that with game music having some kind of larger appeal, or with soundtracks becoming like a serious cultural phenomenon in the West. I don't see that happening at all. But I do think maybe this isn't the last one we ever see.
No, what I wouldn't be surprised, is to see Capcom, which invests heavily in things like these remixes they put out of like Ace Attorney games, where they'll bring in like symphonic organizations to perform rearrangements, or they'll bring in like a jazz quartet. I could see them releasing them for some kind of digital availability. But the problem, and I use the word problem loosely, is that all these things are also available for free on the internet.
Well, that goes for every kind of media that you can make digital.
It right? does, I mean, but the number of... I mean, there are, like, well-established websites that all they do is post game music for download. Yeah. I mean, much more openly than traditional, conventional, big published music.
Well, let me put it this way, James. I could go download illegally that Chrono Trigger remix thing, and I wouldn't even feel that bad about it because it's not even available in my country. But I don't, because I don't like going to those websites where you do that kind of thing. I don't really like the feeling of doing that. You know, I'm very over Napster, 10 years removed. I really could do without downloading stuff illegally. And, you know, if to me, there's a lot to say about the legitimacy of that thing showing up on the store and me being able to buy it with real money. And also, I'm more likely to listen to it if I bought it. There's a certain psychological investment you make when you purchase something. John, close your ears. But when you purchase something, you're more likely to actually use it. And in the case of music, it's very easy. You don't have to carve out a ton of time to listen to a soundtrack. So,
blasphemy!
But I mean, I'll tell you, you can go get a playlist of every single one of those like Ace Attorney jazz games on YouTube right now. You don't have to download anything.
Sure. Yeah, but then YouTube open to listen to it. It's stupid.
I have YouTube on like every device I own at this point.
It's blocked at work. But anyway, I think that the same kind of people that that would buy virtual console games would buy this.
Yeah.
Oh, you know,
yeah.
See, I think the appeal is I think those are a subset. The people who would buy this are a subset of the virtual console purchasers.
Yeah, of course. But I mean, like, the same type of people, the same, you know, like, doesn't really want to do anything illegal, wants to reward the artist.
Sure, I mean, like, this would be the perfect time to release the Earthbound soundtrack. There's so many, look at how many people are playing Earthbound for the very first time, even though that ROM has been on the internet since 1997, okay? I mean, the emulators to play it. I mean, if you really went this long without playing Earthbound, you certainly could have found a way to do it. But having it out there legitimately, it means something to people. And a lot of people are happy to pay for something that they could have gotten for free because they like the format, they like the device that you get it on, and they like knowing, they like feeling like they didn't do anything wrong and they supported the people who made it. So,
Yeah, I've always been surprised that more companies don't actually do this, just for that alone, the fact that, you know, it really doesn't cost them anything to put this stuff up on iTunes, and they might make a little bit of money off it by people that maybe want to amass a collection of game soundtracks.
Sure. Sure. Well, again, it does cost something, but I'm guessing thanks to platforms like iTunes, it's probably a lot cheaper to do a digital only launch of something like this rather than actually having to print CDs and get them distributed out to malls all over America.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that would be moronic.
Exactly. I mean, I'm talking, you know, just do it as cheaply as possible. Just get the MP3s up there on stuff so people can, you know, buy it.
Yeah. So I bet the break-even point is not that high. And, you know, maybe the success of Pokemon, it is a sign of things to come. That would be great. You know, even if they do remain kind of a niche market, I think it would be wonderful if people actually had a selection and the opportunity to buy this stuff. I might even get in on it every now and then. All right, well, the next letter will be read by John Lindemann.
Cliff writes, with Valve's Steam Machine coming in 2014, are any of you guys interested in this alternative as your next-gen machine? I know Valve is renowned for doing things right, but there are a few unknown factors that make the Steam Machine seem like it's not going to be worth it in the end. The controller looks bizarre, and there aren't any many Linux games supported on Steam, but let's say the controller isn't an issue, and assume the games will be there. What features would you like to see from SteamOS that would convince you that it is a better experience not only for PC gaming, but for gaming in general? Could Valve ever convince you to buy one of these PC/consoles?
Yes.
Well, I'm open to the idea of going with PC instead of a new console for future generations of games, but I'm not sure how much I'd, you know, like, to me, a PC also has to be useful. Because usually the expense is so high that, you know, I need to be able to do something else with it.
Yeah, well, you really have to look at this as not a PC, but a console that plays PC games.
Right, but do we have any idea of what the price is going to be?
The first one announced is $500.
That's too high.
Yeah, but
I can buy a PC for $500.
I agree completely. Even if it is a really nice, powerful PC, it's too much for what people expect. I mean, keep in mind, the most avid Steam users are cheap asses because the games are so affordable.
This to me is the ultimate problem with the Steam box, is that PC costs are dropping. And I'm more inclined to buy a PC and put it next to or hook it up to my TV and just get the full PC experience with it.
Yeah, well, I actually think that $500 first one that was announced, I think, a couple of weeks ago, I think that's actually going to be on the high end.
Really?
Because this is not a full-blown PC, they can cut costs, they can leave out certain components, or certain components can
Windows.
Be cheap. Yeah, they leave out Windows, and because of that, they should be able to sell these for less than an equivalent full-size PC.
Yeah.
And so I honestly think that they'll be very capable, and it's an open format, so any company can make a Steam box if they want to, and so there will be a lot of competition, and that will drive down the prices. And I think there will be $200 and $300 ones that'll be a lot more tempting, depending on what they can run.
Well, the thing is, right? So for $500, that's the same price as the Xbox One. If I can play roughly the same games outside of, you know, platform exclusive stuff like Halo or whatever, if I can play the same types of games, probably at higher graphical output than I could with Xbox One for the same price, probably, you know what I mean? That's value to me, you know, because
it's tempting.
It's very tempting. And, you know, you're already, it's not like this is some sort of Ouya type kind of, you know, thing just coming out of nowhere.
It's not a scam.
Well, but, you know, like, it's already,
you know,
like,
you know, it has games on it.
You know, it has games
Steam
on it, and you can tap into an existing library that you probably already have. And the platform,
right,
you know, the platform is very well done. So
yeah, my concern remains that there will be lots of games available on Steam that may not work perfectly well on Steambox.
Or they may not work at all.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the biggest question for me, because Steambox runs SteamOS, and that's a Linux-based system. As far as we know, it only natively plays games that support Steam on Linux, which is a tiny percentage of the full Steam library. Now, and it does some streaming stuff. So if you have a Windows PC somewhere in the house, you can stream the video for that over to your Steam box and play it that way. If that even works well, and I'm not convinced it will, it still requires you to own a big powerful gaming PC, which I don't anymore. So that's a big problem for me. Like, if I'm going to buy a Steam box, it needs to be able to play most of the games out of the box without me having to own a $1,000 gaming PC in the room next door. So it has to be able to run this stuff natively, because that would be the only way I can do it. And that's what I'm waiting to hear from. But I have little interest in an Xbox One, so if I can pick up a powerful Steam box for $400 that plays all those Steam games I already have, plus all the ones that are going to come, I am totally interested in that.
Yeah, I just
don't know if that's what's actually coming out next
year.
Yeah,
I mean,
I'm keeping my eye on it, I can tell you that.
Yeah, oh, yeah, they have a very high hurdle to clear for me at this point, because like I said, I can go buy a PC that does way more than a Steam box does. And they're going to have to prove to me that, A, even if they can get the price below that of a PC, that it's below that enough that the parts that I'm missing out on are worth the price difference.
That's exactly it. Is that gap in feature set worth the cheaper price?
Right.
Because gaming is a large part of how some of us rationalize our PC purchases in the first place,
yep.
Right? It's
sure.
Like, and vice versa. It's like, well, I need a new PC anyway. I might as well spend a little extra and make it good for games, because then I'll get even more use out of it, you know? And so when you separate these things, it does do weird things with your PC math, you know? But for me, I have the Surface Pro now, which is like a very kind of, you know, low power PC. It's versatile, but it's not going to be anybody's gaming PC. And so for me, it's like, this will do all of the actual computing tasks that I want, like running Audacity or whatever, browsing the internet. But if I can separate that out from a Steam box that I use for my actual PC gaming, and it's awesome, and that controller works, and it's compatible with everything I want it to do, and it boots up really fast, and, you know, it has a slick interface, I'm extremely interested in that. Especially if I can get one for a lower price than a new console.
Yeah, I mean, I've been living without a big, powerful gaming PC for a couple of years now.
Yeah, I mean, you're not really a PC gamer. I mean, at least not
I used
lately.
To. I used
never,
to be heavily.
You never talk about PC.
I
games.
Used to be heavily, but you know, I just sort of, when I moved into my first apartment, I left my PC, which had gotten old, relatively old, at my parents' house, and I had a small laptop. I had the netbook that you remember that I had at E3. I've since replaced that with the more powerful laptop, but, you know, it's only a 13-inch screen. It's a low-power machine. It's like an i3. You know, I've kind of lived on these low-power Steam games that work well, but, you know, I don't know that I need the Steam box or the big, powerful machine. The majority of stuff I buy on Steam, I can already play on what essentially is no more than a Surface Pro.
Well, yeah, and you're getting to the heart of why Valve is doing this in the first place, because as much as PC gaming is actually stealing away console gaming to some extent, because it's getting so much better and so much more accessible and more affordable, PC period, gaming or not, is overall trending downward, because people are replacing PCs, people are replacing laptops with stuff like iPads, because iPad does very basic functionality that, you know, most people don't generate content. Most people don't edit podcasts or write very long reviews in Microsoft Word. And you do a lot of Excel spreadsheets. Some of that stuff you can even do on a tablet. But, you know, the kinds of really complex, demanding tasks that PCs are designed to do with very complex input, like a keyboard and mouse, a lot of people just aren't interested in doing that stuff. And so the problem for Valve and for anybody who focuses on PC gaming is that the number of PCs is going way, way down, and it's happening very quickly. So I think, you know, focusing on something like a Steam box, where they might be able to take a lot of the advantages of the platform and put them in a different form factor that some people might find more appealing, is huge. And I think Valve would love for people to think of the Steam box not as a weird PC, but as a weird gaming console, and because they want to appeal to people who would never buy a PC in the first place.
I think they've got a hard sell, though. I think
it's gonna not happen right away.
Yep.
You know, but I think Valve, especially with Steam, Valve has shown that they're willing to be persistent, and when they don't launch something well, they will take the time to make it right eventually, and they will probably do a really good job of it. So I think, you know, Steambox may have a kind of a slow, weird rollout, but I bet you within 2 or 3 years, it'll be a very different story.
Yeah, I mean, no one really thought Steam was going to do anything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Steam was just sort of like Valve's little experiment. People were like, That's kind of cool. Look what Valve is doing over there.
But see, here's the thing, though. They run that. They run Steam. That's their thing. They're not building the Steam boxes.
No, but they're building the platform.
Well,
that's the thing. It's weird. They've created the platform without this actually doing anything about the hardware.
I mean, they aren't creating the games that are sold on Steam either. It's the same thing. Right.
It's just a platform. It's a user interface. It's a store. It's a network community feature all rolled into one. And, you know, that's why they can kind of do this make your own console thing, because all the stuff that makes the console unique and work and be effective and easy to use is already done.
Yeah.
They've got it.
I mean, they already have
Xbox
Live.
It works really well.
You know?
Yeah. Well, they've got Xbox Live and the Wii and the eShop and the PS4, menu interface and everything. I mean, it's all rolled up together.
Yeah, it's like
so,
they've already made the sandbox. It's whatever people want to do in that sandbox.
Yeah, I know, but it'll eventually it's going to fall on other people to promote and execute.
I get the feeling that initially we're only going to see a lot of indie titles and the thing. Like, I can't imagine Ubisoft being that quick at making a you know, Steam OS version of Assassin's Creed 5.
I think it'll depend a lot on the tools that Valve develops for converting games from the Windows platform to the Steam OS. Like, if, you know, it's not straight Linux. It's like a hacked up version of Linux. And we don't know anything about the development tools that they might be, because again, if it's a platform and they really want to treat it like that, just the same way that Nintendo and Sony and Microsoft do, then they do need to develop some developer tools to make it work on their platform. And so I would be, if I'm Valve, I am working very hard on a Windows conversion tool that makes it, you know, maybe a week-long process to put your Windows game onto SteamOS. And if they can make it that painless, then, you know, it may be very easy to convince people to also support this, you know, and then that does wonders for the viability of this thing as a platform.
Yeah, I mean, you have to make it easy to get those early adopters to kind of get the ball rolling. And once people see, like, oh, hey, you know, Ubisoft is putting a game out there, or, you know, EA is doing something or whatever like that, people kind of, you know, I think everybody's kind of looking around and seeing who dips their foot into the deep end of the pool with this.
To me, the only concern I have, and besides the fact that I don't necessarily see this as a device that has a place in my current ecosystem, is I look at the shit that Google went through when they started to spin up Android. And they said, we've built this great platform. It works. There's everything you need to do. All you need to do is build the phones. And everybody who built the phones fucked it up for a long ass time.
True.
It got to the point
and they
where
eventually
Google
made their own phone.
Google
just to show
to go,
everybody.
This
how to
is
do
how
it.
You make a fucking phone. And then people started to do that. It got to the point where Google had to buy a company to get the patents so they could make a phone to show, hey, look, guys, here's how you make a phone.
Well, of course, Valve is already planning to do this. They're going to make their own version of Steambox to compete alongside versions.
But who's going to buy the Steambox that's not made by them?
I don't know. It depends on the price and the features and everything. But at least they're going to do it right. I'm sure they're going to do theirs
well. It's a tough place to be if you've not made hardware before.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, who knows?
But,
I mean,
Google hadn't made hardware before that either.
Oh, yeah, they had. Well, not phones, but they designed their own hardware before to run their own algorithm stuff. They have hardware people.
They didn't do consumer products.
Kinda.
Before the Nexus, whatever, I don't think Google had ever made a consumer product.
No, they
and
just
now they've got the
had.
Chromecast thing. They make all kinds of stuff now. You know, they learned those lessons, and Android's now the largest mobile OS on the planet. So, you know, this can work out. And I don't want to. We're too far down the rabbit hole already, but I think this is very possible.
I would say, you know, you never know what hardware maker might want to jump into the fray with this. Like maybe Samsung makes something.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
Totally.
If there's money to be
made
there.
Sony could make one.
Yeah.
I doubt it, but they could. You know, Sony's different departments don't really talk to each other that much. So
they actually fight with one another. It's remarkable. Sony's different departments are notorious.
Maybe the Vio brand ends up making a Steam box without even asking the PlayStation brand. That would be hilarious.
Yeah, like I said, Sony's departments are notorious for being at each other's throat, mm-hmm. which is remarkable.
Yeah. So maybe they will. All right, look forward to the Sony Steam Box in 2015. James has the next email.
Oh, I do. Look forward to the Sony Shield in 2015.
The MOGA.
We didn't even talk about the shield. That's a whole other bag of worms.
Oh, the shield. So good. So good. Curtis the Red writes, what do you guys think about using light applications, web browsing, and other small games exclusively on the gamepad without the console being turned on? While it might add some weight to the controller, just feeling how light my phone is, I don't think it'll matter that much. While still awkward to carry around, using the Wii U gamepad outside of my living room could be awesome. If you don't think console redesign is in the near future, do you think Nintendo will double down on the gamepad and release the Wii U Gamepad Pro? Holy crap.
I think they will do a Gamepad Pro, but I don't think it'll be what Curtis is suggesting.
I mean, the real situation is the gamepad has, you know, obviously has a processor just to manage its graphical stuff, but it would have to basically be a tablet, which gamepad decisively is not a tablet. It is an input-output device. And that is a huge gulf to cross.
It's a window into what is happening on the actual Wii U system.
And it's a window with the controller mounted to it.
Yeah, I mean, I would liken this to like on Star Trek Voyager when they gave the hologram his own hologram generator, and so he could like leave the room. I don't see that happening. I mean, it really defied all logic, even on Star Trek. And although Nintendo certainly could do it, it just doesn't make much sense. I mean, this thing is gigantic, and it has all these buttons and sticks blasting out of it.
Yeah, and I have
who is going to carry this with them? It's huge, and it's a controller. It's not a tablet. It's not designed to be, traveled with.
Well, and to be perfectly honest, the tablet, even if they did give it some kind of brain, it'd have to have internet access.
Yeah, and so that was going to be my question. Like, could they, like, whatever they're using to beam in the video to the gamepad, like, could that be kind of modified to access a regular Wi-Fi signal or what? Like,
yeah,
no,
probably. Or they could just add a new antenna to it. I mean, then we're talking about
right,
a new version
but
of the
we're
hardware
adding,
anyway.
Right,
they'd have to add a new antenna.
I'm kind of wondering just how much hardware you would have to add to this thing.
You need to add a processor. You need to add some form of memory. You need to
storage.
You need to add network capacity. You'd need to add storage. You'd probably need to add some bus interfaces. You'd probably need to add a sound device. You're not looking at a small or insignificant amount of stuff. But the biggest thing you need to add is you'd need to add software to run the whole damn thing.
Yeah, and the engineering time required to get that stuff down into a small enough size to make it equivalent to the original gamepad.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
If not
yeah,
smaller.
Yeah, you'd also have to develop a whole bunch of software to run on this thing. And right now, I think they seem to me stretched very thin already.
I mean, and the other point is I have a phone. It has the internet all the time. It's in my pocket at all times. I have everything ever written by mankind at my disposal at any point in the world. I don't need another device.
Well, even if you don't already have a smartphone, they already have their own device that already does all this stuff with the 3DS. And if they made the 3DS talk to Wii U a little better than it does right now, and if they develop some stuff that maybe let you take simple data from one to the other, then people might actually do this with another Nintendo platform that does a lot more than just this. So, you know, I think what we've seen is that, yeah, like one or two people are crazy about using the 3DS web browser. But I mean, most people don't want to use a device like that for web browsing.
It's so good.
Outside the home. I mean, some people use it. They're going to write in. They're going to get angry at me.
I've posted on the forums with it. It was actually, I think I posted an article with it to see if I could.
I did that on the original DS. That weird
from the
Opera.
E3, yeah, the article. Yeah.
Oh, that Opera
minutes,
browser,
right. Yes.
I think it was horrible.
Yeah, that article is two sentences long, and it took me like over half an hour to.
Part of that is the LACC Wi-Fi was god awful.
Yeah, yeah, it was very touch and go getting that thing posted, but I love that article. Yeah, I mean, I've said before, I think the Gamepad Pro or something, you know, whatever the name is, I think that probably will happen one day, and it will probably make the gamepad more portable. I mean, I think it will make it thinner and a little smaller and a little more efficient with the space on it, and I think it'll also probably do things like increase the battery life and increase the range on the wireless, if that's possible. I don't know if that's a limiting factor on the system itself or the gamepad. But I think it's feasible they could improve that part. And so then you'd be able to play farther away from the system, and maybe the things like off TV play would become more useful for more people because you're no longer as limited by the layout of your home or whatever. But I don't think it would be something you would take on the bus with you. And again, they already sell a portable system and it was designed for exactly that. And it's really good at it. So I don't think they're going to be pushing the gamepad in that direction.
Now here's an interesting quandary. Would they ever put 3G on a handheld device?
Why? Not after seeing the way it happened for Vita. I mean,
well, they'd have to subsidize it. They couldn't do it.
They couldn't
charge
it.
For it. That's the only way it's going to work is if it's free.
Yeah, so it'd have to be like Amazon WhisperNet, and even that I don't think is really worth the extra cost. I just have a Wi-Fi only Kindle, and I think that's their biggest seller now. So it's like there is a, you know, again, I mean, there's a very select user base who finds that 3G access to be really important. Like if you read 5 books a day and you just cannot fucking wait to get home and get on that Wi-Fi hotspot, then maybe the 3G access is really useful.
Yeah, but I mean, most people don't need that. It's cool when, you know, at the beach or something, I can just, you know, but I mean, do I need
it? Why does it feel like 48% of the use cases for the Kindle revolve around, oh, I'm at the beach, and...
Well, I mean, that's...
And
you do a lot of reading
at the beach.
Download
a couple extra books before I left home.
And that's, but that's the thing. You can just completely circumvent that use case. It's neat to have. Do I need it?
Yeah.
No. Absolutely not.
It's not even those. It's like, even the ones they publicize are, well, when you're at the beach, you can read the screen. When
it's
you're
the
at
most
the beach,
obvious
you can download
case.
Books.
Everyone like, can relate to it, man. Come on. Everybody loves the beach, James.
You guys chill the fuck out.
Puppies. They throw puppies and ice cream in there, and everybody loves it.
I'm like 150 miles from the beach.
Do you need to read when you're playing with your puppy or your kitten?
I'm pretty sure within the next year, all beaches will have Wi-Fi anyway. So even that is going to go away. It just, yeah, 3G is I mean, first off, 3G sucks, okay? I just traded in my Sprint 3G iPhone for a Verizon LTE 4G.
Oh God, you
iPhone.
Went from the dark ages to like the Renaissance.
It's a pretty dramatic difference.
Oh yeah,
okay?
It's huge.
So 3G kind of sucks. It's only good for like very slow things. You can download basic small apps or you can send email, but you know, that's not what 3DS or game, you know, that's not what 3DS is for. So, you know, Sony did this with Vita and everybody looked at it and said, "Why the hell would I want 3G on a Vita?" And the people who bought it came back and said, "Well, turns out I didn't need 3G on the Vita. It doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
You can't play online games, and who's going to check email on a Vita?"
Exactly.
No. Stop.
Yeah.
Go away.
By
the way, Vita games are like 3 gigs, so you're definitely not downloading those over 3G.
It'll only take about 6 to 8 days.
Well you can't even, like, you have to circumvent, like, don't most providers just not allow downloads of over a certain...
I've got consumer protection because you have a bandwidth cap on the Vita. I mean, I think you buy like 2 gigs
a
month or something.
I forgot.
So
yeah, I think
it's
100 megs a lot of places or something like
Are
that.
Are you fucking serious?
I think so, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I do that on my phone every day listening to music.
Yeah. There's more than one plan. So, anyway, it's no. After how could you look at Sony and what they've done with 3G, or rather, what they haven't done, and think that you would want 3G?
Well,
on
so but then if that's the case, then there's really no use case where they could try to build the 3DS into some kind of access device.
Sure, they could. You just do it over Wi-Fi.
But then it would only be when you're in a Wi-Fi hotspot that you've set up.
Right.
Right.
That's what Sony's doing with Vita, and it works pretty well from what I've heard. Okay, great discussion, guys.
I was trying to get back to the core functionality he was looking for in the gamepad.
I mean, yeah, I mean, the idea, I guess if you don't have a 3DS, there's some attraction to being able to take the gamepad and make it truly portable. But that
for 2 hours.
It defeats the purpose in the sense that it would make the gamepad way more expensive, and it's already kind of a giant... it's like a giant stone on the back of Wii U.
Well, and there's already a marketplace full of devices that do what you'd want to do here.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah. I think there could be a GamePad Pro, but it'll be really kind of a more luxurious, more compact version.
Suede.
Yeah. Yeah. They'll put polka dots on it.
I don't think there'll be a GamePad Pro, by the way.
Really?
I think that
I'm kind of in John's camp here.
I think they would ditch the Wii U before they make a GamePad Pro.
I think what you may see is that the GamePad gets some improvements that maybe they don't talk too much about them. It just sort of happens organically because the parts that are cheapest are of slightly better quality than the ones they have now.
I do think there'll be more colors of them in the future.
Well, yeah, that's a different thing than a Pro. There's already been two colors. I mean, colors are an inevitable state of Nintendo hardware.
Yeah, and there's the Zelda one with the little pattern on it. So yeah. I think you'll see more cosmetic stuff like that, and that makes me think even more likely that, yes, eventually they will do a new version of it. I mean, they always iterate their hardware. They always do. And the console itself, I mean, who cares? You know, like they've never been remotely interested in the Wii U console itself.
Can they make it look like a hamburger box? That's really important.
Yeah. I don't think they're going to iterate that for a long time, but the gamepad is where probably the biggest potential cost savings are and the biggest profit margin. So that's where I would focus.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. If they make improvements, I think it'll just be because the parts that are available to them got cheaper, or the parts that are available now that are cheapest are of better quality than the ones they have at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, you can imagine within a couple of years, they could probably put a much better screen on that thing for about the same price.
They end up having to put a better screen on that thing because the one they get now is not being produced.
Well, the one they get now is only used on, I mean, it's a, what is it, like it's a 5-inch non-capacitive touchscreen.
Yeah, it's
I mean,
who super, else uses super bizarro
this technology? It's a humongous old school archaic technology.
It's amazing.
No one else uses this. I mean, maybe they cut it from the same sheet as the 2DS screen, but you know, I
would love to find out that the 2DS is literally just a gamepad screen turned sideways.
I think within the next year, maybe 2 years, the only companies using non-capacitive touchscreens will be Nintendo and LeapPad, which is made for 2-year-olds so that they don't break it.
That's awesome. And the only other thing I can think of is all those weird like third world cell phone. That
yeah. So the gamepad feels like a third world cell phone.
It feels like
yes,
that crazy
they,
cell
of course
phone.
They will make a better version of it.
The gamepad is that crazy cell phone that's come out in the Commonwealth of Independent States. That one side's fucking e-ink.
But see, the problem with the problem with having a new gamepad is the gamepad is so expensive, right? So, in other words, you would piss off everybody that has the old inferior gamepad.
No, you don't, because you release it alongside a game that supports multiple gamepads at the same time. And then you get the crazies
like me. How
much does
that game cost, though?
It doesn't matter. It comes with the GamePad Pro. No, it comes with the GamePad Pro, because remember, everybody who has a Wii U has a gamepad. So if you're buying a GamePad Pro, you're going to have an extra. And you can't just give it to someone else because without the system, it doesn't do anything. So you're going to end up with a whole bunch of people who now have two gamepads. So you package the GamePad Pro with a game that uses two gamepads finally, which they promised for years now, and you make it something really cool and new and exciting that people haven't done before, and you use that to help sell the new hardware, which you make a healthy profit on. Done. Put me in charge.
But how much would that be, though? Like, how much is the gamepad worth? I've heard the gamepad is worth, what, like $100 or something? It's $100 of the price? So what are you going to do? Sell that bundle for $150 or something?
No, you wait until the stuff gets cheaper, and then you can.
You sell
do it
that,
for, bu-
I mean,
well, you come
you sell
back
that
to
bundle
that happens,
for a
Johnny
billion Mets. Million dollars.
Look, I'm obviously not predicting this to happen next week.
I can't wait for the unannounced Nintendo Direct next week.
It's going to happen at VGX. That's what's going to happen.
It's going to be unannounced Nintendo Direct when they go, we heard this idea from some dude. It's awful.
Actually, traditionally, Nintendo does make an announcement in the week between Christmas and New Year's, because it's about 3 months before the end of their fiscal year, and I think they originally announced the Nintendo DS during that time period.
They did.
They
hinted
Lite
about it for a while, and then they announced
that.
It. Like, what the fuck are you guys on?
Yeah. So don't be surprised if there's a Nintendo Direct on December 28th.
Oh, it'll be ridiculous.
It'll be awesome.
Be honest.
I'm never surprised by anything Nintendo does.
Sorry, we interrupted you, Guillaume.
No, the moment has passed.
Okay.
It's the last forever.
All right. Well, the last email this week comes from Ed. And Ed is a longtime listener, and he contacts us on Twitter, but he usually doesn't write emails. He finally wrote, this was actually a very long email that I cut a snippet out. I thought it was kind of interesting, especially with John back on the show this week. So Ed writes, a game I played recently on Virtual Console was Star Fox 64. Never really played it extensively on the Wii. I think I meddled most of the planets back in the late 90s. With the N64 feeling cocky, I went straight to Corneria. That resulted in me being clueless with the yellow C buttons, so was useless in situations that required loops, turbo, or slowing down. I did not lose an R-Wing till I had to rescue Slippy. I was shocked I was not able to stop the bomb in the Star Wolf level. I did not earn any alternate routes. What disturbed me, though, was after or during the first asteroid level, I felt a sensation I never felt in gaming. I had this soreness on the base of my right palm a little bit before the wrist. When I started to lose ships, I was demotivated to defeat the boss. The discomfort was a factor. I have to admit, I thought of my gaming mortality. Charles Barkley is often quoted as saying, "Father Time is undefeated." Does this discomfort start with Star Fox 64 and then slowly spread to other games? Is this the beginning of the end to the joy I derive from gaming? Maybe this phenomenon is unreported or underreported considering the time console gaming has been around, and there can't be a significant sample size of people like me who have been console computer gaming in one form or another for 37 years. I have no idea if I have carpal tunnel syndrome or arthritis. Nothing else so far triggered these suspicions except for Star Fox 64. John Lindemann.
Well,
you've been playing games for 37 years.
What's your prognosis?
I don't know. It could be carpal tunnel. I don't know. That's the whole thing. I think as you get older, your joints get worse as you get older, you know? And I don't think that that's any different from your knees. I mean, your knees eventually start to go. I can tell you that mine are absolutely
But you don't need your
screwed.
Knees to play video games.
True, Johnny. True, Johnny, but
if
your fingers
connect,
are joints
you
nonetheless.
Need your knees.
Your fingers are joints nonetheless. So I would say that over time, if you're using those joints a lot, like we do in video gaming, it just stands to reason that over time, maybe you would, you know, develop a little bit of soreness, maybe a little bit of, you know, kind of wear and tear on your fingers.
Or maybe you become aware, or even that, or maybe just it's not necessarily the root cause. I mean, arthritis is a thing that happens. Maybe it's
exactly.
You notice it because it's a tactile thing that requires a certain amount of dexterity that arthritis hinders.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's more than one form of it. Some of
Is
hereditary and some of it is triggered by repetitive stress.
Yep. Yeah.
But this is a little scary to me. Like, I think my grandmother used to be like a secretary at a bank, and she eventually retired when her arthritis and her fingers got so bad that she couldn't use a typewriter anymore.
Yeah.
Now, that forced a career change for her. If that made me have to give up video games, I would be
super I'll tell you right now,
depressed.
The medication to manage arthritis pain is tremendously better than it was even 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh,
but
okay.
But
well,
for
really
example, my mom, who is she's 76, but she has rheumatoid, which causes all her joints to swell. So she cannot open up. I mean, I have to open up all of, you know, jars for her and stuff like that, or she has to, you know, kind of jigger different ways to open up jars and stuff like that because her joints are just either too swollen, they're too sore, or they're too weak to do so. So, I mean, that happens, right? And I mean, and that's the thing, you can actually get that fairly early, right?
And she's got that sweet-ass Canadian healthcare.
Yes.
So,
like
if there was something good for this, she probably would be taking it.
Yeah. And I mean, and you know, James is right. I mean, there's a lot better medicine out there now for it, but she still takes like 5-6 pills a day for it. Like, she takes a cocktail of drugs for her, you know, her condition. And there's no way she could play video
games.
There's
a reason
there's
like a whole category of devices that were invented just for opening jars for arthritic people.
Well, of course, keep in mind, this is part of the appeal of Wii and Wii Bowling. Remember, that's a game that you can play basically without having to use your fingers.
That's very true.
You know, you move your arm, and that's something that is not as affected in most older people. And that's why you ended up seeing Wii show up in nursing homes, and you have like these tournaments of 90-year-olds doing Wii Bowling is because they can play it without – it's not just the dexterity of knowing how to use a controller. Like, that's part of the mind game, right, is that Nintendo says, look, you don't have to be intimidated by this complicated thing. But I think maybe there's a physical aspect to it is like they can actually use a Wii remote and they couldn't actually use other controllers because it's too painful or they just don't have the flexibility to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
there's something to be said for iPads and Wii remotes.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Like
it's also the appeal of capacitive touchscreens and definitely a reason why, you know, so many older people prefer it to a laptop or something like that. It's just, you know, well, yeah, it's very easy to use.
Well, it's one reason that back in probably around, you know, 2005, 2006, 2007, I did not really want to be playing a bunch of DS games that required me to use the stylus because I was in graduate school and sometimes I was writing all day long. When I get home and play video games, I don't want to pick up a stylus, you know? And that made me lean more towards doing things with the buttons because I didn't want to have to do that same activity all over again.
Yeah. I mean, I think also too, as you age, I think video games, you know, they're kind of rough on your hands and on your joints, but I think they also sometimes require you to do things that require you to, you know, perhaps keep a lot of pressure in one place at a certain time. And when you're young, it doesn't matter because, you know, your joints are young and you can, you know, all your muscles are really strong and they haven't had a chance to get weak. I mean, as you get older and you kind of, your lifestyle changes, there's some muscles that you just don't use as much as when you were running around as a kid, biking and doing all that kind of stuff, right? So, you know, I mean, I can tell you, I mean, I think it's probably a lot like anybody that stares at a computer screen for 8 to 10 hours a day. After a while, that has an effect on your eyes. And as you get older, you know, your eyesight starts to go because it's just, you know, it's just that stuff affects over time. It affects your vision. And I would go ahead, you go.
To be honest, like one of the reasons why I'm so into WeFit U at this point is because I can't really sit down for as long as I could before. You know, I'm already sitting down at work all day long, and then I find it kind of unbearable after a while when I'm playing video games at night. And it's just, you just can't do it anymore.
Yeah,
and
well,
it wouldn't have been a problem just 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, your back muscles get weak and from just, you know, not being used.
It's even the kind of sitting that you do. Like the place that I'm staying here temporarily, the only chair in the room is an office chair. And I'm not complaining because I didn't have to buy it. I mean, it was there for me when I moved in, and it's been nice to have. But I don't want to come home and sit in front of my TV in an office chair and play Mario when I've been sitting in an office chair for 9 or 10 hours already that day at work. And that's one reason I went out and bought a couch almost as soon as I moved in, because I was like, I need a more relaxing environment. Even if I'm still sitting down or lounging while I play games, at least it's not another freaking office chair. Because that, I can't sit on that even longer than I already do. It's bad for me and it's uncomfortable and it makes me think of being at work, and I don't want to think of that when I'm not at work. There's any number of reasons. But just to get back to Ed's letter a little bit, you know, I mean, I'm not that kind of doctor, but I do want to diagnose this a little better and maybe figure out what
might be triggering this. You are technically a kind of doctor.
Yeah, I'm a kind of, trust me, I'm a doctor. But just looking at the information that Ed did provide to us, I think there might be a clue. I'm going to throw this out there for him and see if maybe this makes sense. But, you know, at first I thought maybe he was playing Star Fox 64 on Virtual Console, because he did mention it earlier in his letter. But he talked about the C buttons, the yellow C buttons later on. So if he was actually digging up an actual N64 or using some weird adapter or something to use an N64 controller to play Star Fox 64, that is not the most comfortable controller I've ever held. And I wonder if maybe it's just playing on that thing, especially if you're not used to it, if you haven't played N64 in a long time, picking up that controller, it might kind of do weird things to your hands. And, you know, the good thing is, this is one thing I love about stuff like Virtual Console and the PS1 classics and things like that, is that you can play these older games with newer controllers. And the new controllers are usually more ergonomic, they're more comfortable, they require less contortion and grip of your hands, so you can relax a little bit more when you're playing. And, you know, if you have the option, I might try playing the game again with a more modern controller, like the Classic Controller Pro, for instance, which I guess would be the newest one that you could play on Virtual Console, and give that a shot. Or maybe if you have a 3DS XL, maybe pick up the 3D version and try it that way. That seems less comfortable actually to me, but for some people that might be better, especially if you use the Kid Icarus stand. So, you know, maybe you can find a way that... Like, look, video games should never be painful to play, right? So, I mean, if you feel pain, you should stop, and you should ice down
power
your hands,
through.
Maybe.
Walk it off.
No, you should take a break, you should ice your hands, ice your wrists, and maybe try to hold the controller in a different way, or if you have the option, use a different controller. and you know, find a way that works for you. I bet there's something out there for a game like this, especially. I bet there's something out there that you could use to play it that would cause you less discomfort, and hopefully that lets you, you know, perform a little better and also be able to play it longer without having to stop.
I would say also stretch your hands too. You know, like bend them backwards, like towards the wrist. I mean, that helps
like
more than
players.
Yeah, I mean, that helps you more than you think, right? Because a lot of times, you know, it. What happens is, you know, when you're doing any activity for a long period of time, your muscles will tense up, and they you have to stretch them out to actually get that doesn't go down by itself.
Absolutely.
Well, until you know, a while afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, playing video games is usually not a very physical activity, but it is very physical for your hands. Like, it's the one part of your body that you're actually using a lot when you play video games. And you know, if you're gonna sit there for 4, 5, 6, 8 hours and play games, you need to take care of your hands, and you need to take care of your eyes. You need to give your eyes rest. If you're wearing contacts, you might want to think about getting a pair of glasses for when you play games for really long periods of time. And you know, take breaks, use eye drops, things like that. Stay hydrated. I mean, this sounds really stupid, like giving health tips on how to play video games. But like, people forget this, you get addicted, you get immersed, and you forget to do this stuff, and it can have really negative consequences. And a lot of this is probably avoidable.
Well, and one thing that, you know, we've talked about it before, actually. We've had some of this conversation before. One thing you also need to be really aware of, and Nintendo's stupid, hey, you've been playing a while notices, don't always cover it,
right.
Is that video games can be mentally either both taxing and hypnotic. And sometimes your brain, like any other part of your body, needs to rest sometimes. And get away from it, because it'll cloud your judgment and will potentially make things worse on the physical side as well, because you're just you go into a stupor.
Well, you know this about as well as anybody, James. I mean, I cannot play games for 8 hours. And I know you don't do it all the time, but sometimes you get really locked into a game and you can play it for a long, long time. I can't do that. Like, physically and mentally, I have to take a
break. I'm never not consciously aware of what I'm doing when it goes that long. I'm sure. Running the numbers in my head. It's that middle band that...
You're like, I've trained for this. I know I can do it.
It's that 2 to 3 hour window where I'm not feeling any discomfort that, like, I can kind of glass out and just not.
And then you get to the water station, and it kind of gives you a renewed energy.
It's a little
marathonic for that 26.2.
But no, I mean, the games I can do for 8 hours are a very specific subset of games. They're either RPGs that are not like Xenoblade. They're much more passive style RPGs. To an extent, they're strategy games, because although you have to think in those games, there's a certain amount of repetition in how the mechanics of each game work. So once you learn them, you're not thinking that much anymore. You're just sort of replaying these scenarios in your head. They're games that really don't require a lot of rapid eye movement or lots of quick decision making. They're either games where you're planning out far in advance and you're just sort of executing on the plan, or they're games where the action's coming at you at a very slow pace. And if it's anything but those, I can't do it. I can't lock in for more than a couple hours or I'm out. And I think it really does come down to that. For it's the individual by person and it's individual by game. So really, you just need to learn what your mortality is and then back out.
I mean, that's the best advice of all, is like, pay attention to your body and to your brain. And, you know, watch for signs of maybe fatigue, you know, and there's different kinds of that. But, you know, just pay attention to what you're doing and how it's affecting you, and respond accordingly.
And learn from what you've seen in the past, because ideally you want to stop before the fatigue sets in. So eventually you can kind of learn, okay, I need to lay off, you know, after a couple hours. So you can stop before.
And by the way, playing anything for 12 hours is a bad idea.
Or it's a great idea.
I don't care how much you love Dota, it is a bad idea to play a game for 12
exactly.
hours. Any game, it's just not – it's straight up not healthy.
Yeah.
Don't do
anything for 12
even,
hours. It doesn't matter what it
is. Yeah, even if you're capable, and some people I know can totally play a game for 12 hours and get that addicted to it, don't. That is a bad thing. And by the way, there are other things going on in life. So at some point, you should probably find something else to do.
I honestly can't think of a single thing at all in the world that if you do it for 12 hours straight is a good idea.
Not even sleeping.
Not even like anything. I mean, walking around, no. Hanging out with people, no, because eventually the social pressure of that will get to your brain. I mean, there's really nothing that your body is built to handle for that amount of time. We are.
That's a very strong statement, and I.
We are remarkably fragile creatures for being the apex predator of the world.
And that is the statement of the year. Where else do you get this but RFN? People?
There you go.
Yeah, I know.
Nintendo games.
And specifically, James is the apex.
I'm the apex of a lot of things. The Predator ain't one of them.
That's going to stick with me for a while.
I think also with playing games, because and a lot of times with games, they feel very minimal and efficient, right? Like you can control this entire world with only your thumbs, maybe a couple of index fingers, and your eyes. And you can shut down the rest of your body. You can really just be very still and not waste energy on it. And because of that, it feels like you should be able to go much longer than if you were, say, running around doing stuff, right? But those parts of your body that you do still have to use, they get tired too.
Eyes especially.
And you need to give them a break just like anything else.
There are a ton of muscles in your eyes. And you could screw them up pretty badly if you overtax them.
Yeah, you know, you ever felt the twitchy eye thing? That's exhaustion. That's because your eyes need rest. You need more sleep. You need more rest. Do things that you can close your eyes and still do, like listen to music or a podcast. We're helping you. We're giving you the ammunition you need.
We're giving this for free. Other people will charge you for this, folks.
That's right.
Yeah. We would, but we can't.
All right. Well, that is going to wrap up listener mail. I thought that was a really good batch, and we dealt with some topics that we hardly ever talk about.
We got deep too. That's the thing.
We had some after school specials this week.
Yeah, we went some places. With that. You know, there were some tear shed.
I'm telling you, man. So thanks everyone for writing in, and of course we can't read every single letter that we get on the show, but we do read all of them. We often will give personal responses, especially if we don't get a chance to put it on the podcast, and we really appreciate every letter. So if you have a question or a topic you'd like to bring up to us, a story to tell, whatever, you can send that to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and we will try to get to some more letters very soon on the show. That is going to wrap it up for the entire episode. So thank you so much for listening. Thanks to Guillaume, John, and James for being here every week and working so hard on the show. And thank you for listening. We wouldn't do it if no one listened. We talk about maybe we probably would, but I think actually.
It would be difficult.
So, yeah. And it wouldn't be nearly as much fun without all the comments and the feedback and the letters and the participation. And so thank you guys. Thank you very much.
I need to know that I'm a trendsetter.
That's right.
I'm very sorry to report.
Actually, Guillaume is
I'm out of here.
Guillaume is on NeoGAF now, so he's joined the cult.
Yeah, it's impressive.
By the way, if you do appreciate the show and you get something out of it and you've never left a review over at iTunes, please go do that. It only takes a minute. And if you already use iTunes, it's very easy to go find the show and fill out the little form, give us a little rating, and it actually is a big help. So try to mention that every now and then. I know some people have done it, and we really do appreciate that. Please check it out if you get a chance. That's it. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Later.
Bye. I mean, you could just get the Vita and get rid of the PSP Go. I mean, the Vita can play all kinds of shit, and the PSP Go just plays PSP games.
Yeah, but who's going to buy it from him?
Oh, no, he'll have to burn it. He'll have to burn it. That's the only answer.